This week, Coca-Cola opened its newest bottling plant in one of the few countries on Earth that did not already have one, Myanmar in Southeast Asia, also known as Burma. It's been 60 years since Coke has been made there, and luring customers back is not easy. Robert Smith with our Planet Money team has the story.
For years, the only countries left on Earth without Coke were Cuba, North Korea, and Myanmar. The U.S. had slapped sanctions on them all. But last summer, the restrictions started to be lifted for Myanmar, and Coca-Cola executives hopped the first plane to Yangon.
It was literally a trip back in time. You know, it was like you have taken a time warp, but backwards.
Shekhar Moyne is in charge of marketing Coca-Cola in the region. He grew up in Pakistan. He knows how hard it is to do business in a developing country. But Myanmar was so far behind.
Very few cars, no cell phone connection. Internet connection was only available at the hotel.
Still, as he looked around, he saw an amazing opportunity for Coke. Here was an untapped market of nearly 60 million people. And everyone in the country seems to have a sweet tooth. On street corners, you can see these vendors. Guys with giant stalks of sugar cane. They squeeze it through a press, sell you the juice.
And chase it.
And that just means sugar water, right?
Yes, sir.
They love their sugar water here. And Coke could have been huge in Myanmar, if not for the sanctions. Instead, during the years of government repression, people drank counterfeit Coke. A young man I met, So Tat, says he made do with local brands like Max Cola and Star Cola.
Star Cola is a slight imitation of a Coca-Cola. So we really want to try the real things here.
After his first visit, Shakir knew that Myanmar was ready. Some people had even been secretly smuggling Coke across the border.
There was cans from Thailand, cans from Vietnam, and cans from Singapore.
But this turned out to be the first big problem for the comeback of Coca-Cola. The bootleg Coke was expensive. Not many people drank it. And when Shakir started to talk to people, he realized that Coke had gotten this elite reputation.
The imagery that they had of Coke was for the extremely rich and well-to-do people.
You can't sell millions of bottles of your product if it is considered the Dom Perignon of sugar water. So Shakir hatched a plan to change the way an entire country thought of Coke. First, he had to tackle that price problem. And when Coke started to bottle their product inside Myanmar, Shakir did something they almost never do, printed the price right on the label. 300 chet, it says, the local currency, about 33 cents. That way, stores could not get away with charging high prices for Coke.
And we want to make sure that Coca-Cola is affordable for everyone who wants to buy it.
It worked, even though when I bought my first Coke in Myanmar, the woman tried to charge me more than the official price.
$350.
What does she say? She wants to charge me $350?
Yes.
Even though it says $300. She eventually gave up. So now that Coke was cheap, Shakir had to tackle his second big problem. Most of the country had never actually tasted Coca-Cola. They knew the idea of Coke, but not the flavor. And this is a marketing challenge the company hasn't had to face in decades. Normally, no one has to explain Coke. Shakir went to the company archives, and he looked back through all the advertising. And he finally found the perfect model. There was another time when Coke had to introduce itself to a country that didn't know a thing about it. It was more than 100 years ago when Coke was first invented.
So literally the first stop was 1886 Atlanta.
Atlanta, birthplace of Coke. No one had tasted it back then, and soda fountains there used free samples to spread the word. They're doing the same thing now in Myanmar, going into neighborhoods and giving out ice-cold bottles, along with an instruction sheet on how to properly drink Coke. 3 ice cubes, pour at a 45-degree angle, squeeze of lime. Shakir says he also found his new slogan for his bottle back on posters from the 1800s.
The messaging in the early days was that it's a delicious product and it refreshes you. So if you were to walk down the streets of Myanmar, that's singularly the only messaging that you would find on Coca-Cola. It's delicious and refreshing.
It sounds a little more profound in the local language. I asked a guide at one of the Buddhist temples to read the new Coke label out loud.
It's Myanmar language called Ayada Shige, good, delicious, and fresh mind.
Fresh mind.
Fresh mind. If you drink, you can get a clear mind.
My guide, Kin Nguyen, says normally he drinks tea, but he'd give this bottle a try. Robert Smith, NPR News.
The justices of the U.S. Supreme Court are in the midst of writing decisions in two major same-sex marriage cases, While the rest of us wait, though, we'll take a look at the judge who 10 years ago wrote the first decision legalizing same-sex marriage. It was a decision based on the Massachusetts Constitution.
She was the Chief Justice of Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court. Margaret Marshall, now retired, is a white South African immigrant to the U.S., appointed by a Republican governor to serve on the state's high court and promoted to lead that court by a second Republican governor. NPR Legal Affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg has this profile.
Margaret Marshall grew up in a small South African village, the unpolitical daughter of unpolitical parents. But in 1962, she came to Wilmington, Delaware as a high school exchange student. It was a tumultuous time in the U.S. The civil rights movement was heating up. There was violence in the South. People died. But none of that discouraged her.
It was raucous, and it was challenging, and it was difficult. But nobody suggested that one would be imprisoned simply for expressing a view or having an idea or reading a book or attending a movie.
All things that were crimes in South Africa. And she was experiencing something else, too.
A recognition that one could question. One could question the government, as my American family did every day after we listened to Walter Cronkite.
And then there was the library. In South Africa, she never could pick out any book to read because so many were banned. Now, for the first time, she could read anything, including Alan Paton's Cry the Beloved Country.
I think I learned more about South Africa during that year in Wilmington, Delaware, than I had learned in my entire life.
She returned to South Africa after that year, but she was no longer the same girl.
Once one's mind is opened, it's very difficult to shut it again. And I literally felt as if the blinders had been removed from me, and so I began to see and observe and perceive.
By then, Nelson Mandela was already in prison. In college, Marshall joined the National Union of South African Students, a coalition of student councils opposed to apartheid. And she began attending the trials of anti-apartheid activists, including the lawyer who'd represented Mandela.
I'm not quite sure why I did that, but I felt in some way that I had to bear witness in that fundamental religious Christian sense. Every time, of course, I went to court and sat in the whites-only section of the public galleries, I knew that I was being watched by the security police.
Almost without knowing it, she was, as she would later, be challenging the authority of the state to unilaterally define people. Then came a turning point.
1966 was one of the bleakest years in a bleak time in South Africa. All of the political leaders who your listeners will recognize were in prison or out of the country or killed. And there really was no vibrant opposition.
Her student organization invited Senator Robert Kennedy to come. The speech he delivered was a lifeline.
It was a clarion call at a time when we felt so marginalized.
Each time a man stands up for an ideal or acts to improve the lot of others or strikes out against injustice, he sends forth a tiny ripple of hope, and crossing each other from a million different centers of energy and daring, those ripples build a current which can sweep down the mightiest walls of oppression and resistance.
In 1968, Marshall returned to the U.S. for graduate school. She didn't intend to stay.
And then, like generation after generation of immigrants, I fell in love with the United States, deeply in love with this country, and frankly, it's a love affair that has never ended.
The United States was, she says, a safe haven for her. But now that she was safe, she began to have terrifying nightmares, a sort of PTSD hearkening back to her life in South Africa.
I could be arrested in the middle of the night and then would just disappear. And no lawyer would have access to me. No family member would have access to me. I would simply disappear.
Over and over in our interview, she returned to one theme, the rule of law. Under apartheid in South Africa, the law was an instrument of oppression. Parliament passed laws, but no court could invalidate them. Completely different from the American system of a written constitution and a Bill of Rights.
You, as an individual citizen, you have the right to challenge a law that your government enacts through its normal process.
Although she had not planned to be a lawyer, her path in the U.S. led eventually to Yale Law School, private practice, president of the Boston Bar Association, followed by a position as vice president and general counsel at Harvard University, and then the state's highest court. Indeed, if you look at Margaret Marshall's life and career, you might reasonably conclude that she's a combination of the ultimate establishment figure and the ultimate anti-establishment figure. She laughingly concedes the point, knowing that however distinguished her 14-year career on the bench, she'll be remembered most for her 2003 opinion striking down the state law that banned same-sex marriage. She maintains that she simply had not focused on the issue at all until it reached her court, and that she had no tingling feeling of a historic moment.
Massachusetts is one small part of the United States. It never occurred to me that this would be, in any sense, a groundbreaking decision.
What did surprise her, she says, was the huge national, even international, reaction afterwards, both pro and con. The heart of the decision, she says, is in fact the answer to this question posed at the U.S. Supreme Court by Justice Antonin Scalia when the issue was argued there in April. Just when, he asked, did it become unconstitutional to bar same-sex marriage?
When did it become unconstitutional?
And my answer was very clear. When the state started giving huge benefits and privileges to one section of the population. If you're married, you have just enormous benefits. And if you're in the same committed, lengthy relationship, but you happen to be with in the same gender, you have none of those benefits and protections.
And what if the Supreme Court reaches a different conclusion than the one reached by her court? Marshall is unperturbed by that possibility, noting that state courts often lead the way decades before the U.S. Supreme Court comes around. In 2010, Marshall, then 65, stepped down from her post as Chief Justice.
I retired because my beloved husband, Tony, had been diagnosed with Parkinson's disease, and I retired in order to spend more time with him.
In March, Anthony Lewis, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, died. Marshall now has returned to her old law firm, where she mentors young lawyers but does not appear in court, and she teaches at Harvard Law School. And like everyone else, she's waiting to see what the U.S. Supreme Court does on the issue of same-sex marriage. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
Time now for our music project, Heavy Rotation. Every month, NPR Music asks our colleagues at public radio stations around the country to pick a favorite track playing on their station. And then we feature one of those songs on Morning Edition. Today, it's St. Paul, where reporter Andrea Swenson keeps tabs on local music for The Current on Minnesota Public Radio.
I kind of act as a liaison between the community and the station and help them find new stuff and write about the music that we're adding to rotation.
Swenson likes a new song from a musician Minnesotans know well. His name is Sean Tillman. He's from Owatonna. His fans know him as Harmar Superstar.
This is definitely more of that vintage soul sound than he's ever explored before, and kind of trying to channel, you know, the Otis Reddings and the Sam Cookes of the world.
What else can I do if you are untrue? I'll get back in line behind the other guy. There's a chance you'll let me.
In channeling Sam Cooke, Swenson says in this song, Harmar Superstar refers to the singer's death.
Lady You Shot Me is actually the final words that Sam Cooke ever said. He was actually shot to death in a motel in 1964, and when he was shot by the motel worker, he said, Lady, you shot me.
Harmar Superstar is known around the world, but he has not forgotten his Minnesota roots.
People here love seeing Harmar and love, he likes to play little bars in town like the Triple Rock, and he'll jump up on the bar and people just really get into it.
Lady, You Shot Me by Harmar Superstar. That's what's in heavy rotation this month on The Current at Minnesota Public Radio. You can listen to more songs from the series at nprmusic.org. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Linda Wertheimer.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. This month, NPR is taking a closer look at the various types of media available to children: TV shows, apps, games, toys, and in this next story, music. For more than 40 years, Jose Luis Orozco has been entertaining children with music he sings in both English and Spanish. As NPR's Mandalit Del Barco reports, he's passionate about teaching children to be bilingual through song.
Buenos días.
Jose Luis Orozco manages the near impossible, getting hundreds of small children to pay attention.
Good morning.
He entertains them the old-fashioned way, alone with his guitar, asking them to sing, dance, and clap along, and pretend to make hot chocolate with their hands. The kids count and do the ABCs. They dance the Macarena and imitate animals.
These are important tools for children to help them with oral language development, with literacy, body movement, coordination.
Orozco says he wants Latino children to love the music as much as he does.
Many abuelitas, many parents know the songs that they have learned as kids. It's important, yeah, to tell the parents que los canten a los niños. We have a rich tradition and it's important to pass it on.
Orozco was born 65 years ago in Mexico City and grew up listening to children's musician Cri Cri on the radio. His mother and grandmother sang many of the same tunes he croons today. When he was 7 years old, he joined the Mexico City Boys Choir.
We were the little Mexican ambassadors. I got to see the world. We sang before five different presidents.
Here's Orozco solo in 1959 at the National Theater in Santiago, Chile. Orozco eventually made his way to the San Francisco Bay Area with $50 in his pocket. Back then, in the 1970s, Berkeley's innovative bilingual education programs were blossoming, and Orozco was hired to teach music. He remembers the political fights over the public school's federally funded programs.
It's been controversial, but now not as much. I'm so happy to visit dual language schools because there is, you know, an open heart. Kids appreciating this diversity, understanding of other cultures, and respect.
Orozco left his job as a vice chancellor of the National Hispanic University to start a publishing company for his recordings and books. His latest project, Caramba Kids, promotes fitness and good eating habits. At an elementary school in Montebello, east of L.A., Orozco sang, then talked about Mexican history, and he asked the kids about their futures.
Who wants to be president of the United States? Yes, you can. Si se puede.
Ten-year-old Destiny Duarte and nine-year-old Natalie Cortez say Orozco inspired them.
My parents will tell me, sing in Spanish, come on, and I'll be too shy, but he made it really fun. Every time I would be annoyed by the Spanish music that my mom and dad would play whenever it's a celebration, and I would be really annoyed, and this made me not annoyed, so I loved it.
Not annoying. That's high praise from this crowd. Orozco's catchy repertoire left an impression on even the youngest in the audience. After his concert, my 19-month-old daughter Amaya sang all the way home. Mandalit Del Barco, NPR News.
Oh, this is NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Audie Cornish. The Great Salt Lake in Utah is, as its name suggests, very salty. It also emits a putrid smell and swarms with brine shrimp and flies. Still, this weekend, several dozen people are expected to race in a swimming marathon out on the Great Salt Lake, and some people swim there regularly. NPR's Howard Berkus tells us why.
This is a lake so great it covers 1,700 square miles. It's five times saltier than the ocean with storms that bring surfable waves. It has brine shrimp that swim right into swimsuits and brine flies that fly right into mouths. This Great Salt Lake is the perfect place for a good long swim.
If you can swim here, you can swim pretty much anywhere. You have all the different facets of difficult open water, wide variety of temperatures, wide variety of wind direction, currents, and it's fun.
Surgical technician Stacy Schluckbeer stands in a circle of six swimmers in the parking lot of the Great Salt Lake Marina, about 16 miles west of Salt Lake City. They're all in swimming suits, and they like the open water of reservoirs, lakes, and even oceans. Once a week at least in the fall, winter, and spring, they'll dip into this lake and swim from 400 yards to 6 miles.
It's so huge, and boat traffic is light. On a normal day, you're lucky to even see one boat, so it's a very safe place to swim.
Safe from jet skis and motorboats, says school teacher Goody Tyler. The salt is tough on them, and it's also tough on swimmers. Even the taste stands out, says software developer Gordon Gridley, who swam the English Channel last summer.
The Great Salt Lake was like swallowing a battery, whereas swimming in the ocean was like a glass of lemonade.
And in some ways, the ocean is easier on the swimmers than the lake.
If you swallow the water, that could be potentially hazardous. You could end up throwing your guts up. And I guess the other main thing is getting chafed. Because it's so salty, it's almost like sandpaper rubbing against you. And it doesn't take long before you start to get blistered up. And in some cases, it's just really, really painful. It burns. So that's why we put the grease on.
The grease is a combination of Vaseline and lanolin, and it glistens on the skin of the swimmers as we talk. They learn to breathe through their nostrils while swimming to avoid inhaling lake water. That also helps with brine flies.
They'll fly right in your mouth and sometimes right down into your lungs, and then you're coughing up not water, but brine flies.
They get so bad in late summer, swimmers take a break from the lake. Still, the nuisances add up to bragging rights, to gnarliness for Salt Lake swimmers.
You're hardcore. When you're out here, you are hardcore. You're not just, you know, just a pool swimmer, or you're just not, you know, just... You're out here, no wetsuit, you're swimming in the salt, you know, it's, you're the real deal.
I think we're going in by the boat ramp, George.
And there's nothing hardcore about talking to me in a parking lot, so the swimmers walk down a concrete boat ramp and into the water, dragging inflated bright orange bags so they're easily spotted by sailboats and each other. The other big attraction for doing this is the setting. A vast and stunning inland sea, framed by snow-capped mountain ranges and its own mountainous islands.
Swim was good. Felt great.
Back at the marina, Goody Tyler rinses off the salt and issues a challenge, a way to sense some of what the swimmers experience without actually slipping on a Speedo and joining them.
Go down to the water and just get a handful, put it in your mouth, and then spit it out. Just try it.
Oh, man, that is salty. Oh.
Oh. You'll never forget it.
I won't.
Ugh, I haven't. It took a gallon of sweet tea to get rid of that skanky taste, which won't deter the marathon swimmers this Saturday. They'll wade in at a brown and jagged island in the distance. It's 8 miles from there to here. That's more than 3.5 hours in the brine, enough to begin the curing process. Last year after the race, the swimmers stuck out their tongues. The most wrinkled, reddened, and pickled flesh won a special prize, a jar of pickles. Howard Berkus, NPR News, at the Great Salt Lake.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Linda Wertheimer. Let's go to Brazil now, one of several stories we're bringing you about crime in Latin America. Brazil has the biggest economy in the region, but it's also one of the most crime-ridden countries in South America.
Now, Brazil is set to host two major international sporting events, the World Cup next year and then the Olympics in 2016, which motivated the city of Rio de Janeiro to start a program called Pacification. Military police occupied various shanty towns there to stop drug trafficking and arms dealing.
As NPR's Lourdes Garcia Navarro reports, these efforts have helped somewhat. Violence is down in Rio, but it's moved to the countryside.
I'm in the central square of Magé. Like any provincial town, the square has a fountain, a bandstand, children are playing, older people are sitting on the many park benches dotted around underneath the shade of trees. Magé is around 50 kilometers outside of Rio, close enough that people can commute to the big city to work, which most of them do, far enough away that not much really happened here. But that is changing, say residents.
There has always been drug trade, right? But here, compared to the city, to Rio, it has always been quite small. It's always been like local, young people. But now what people have been saying is that there are different people coming in from different places.
That's a Magé local. He doesn't want to give his name. In fact, no one in Magé wanted their name used because they are afraid of retribution from the drug gangs.
There's a general feeling that the things are much worse now than they used to be, I don't know, a couple of years ago, meaning the intensity has increased of demonstrations of gun power.
Just the other night, he says, he was woken up by the sound of heavy machine gun fire. And that's unusual for Magé. He says people see what is happening here as the direct result of pacification in the state capital, Rio.
Criminals in pacified favelas, they're not being arrested, all of them, right? They actually run away. When these people run away, they go to these towns like Magé, like Niterói, which are cities that are close enough to the capital, to Rio. So they are kind of free for them to go in and do their business.
The policy of pacification began several years ago, ahead of the Olympics and the World Cup. The idea is that specialized units of military police occupy Rio's favelas or shantytowns, providing a permanent presence that would curb violence. And it's been a success in some places. Certain favelas are more peaceful. Places that used to be controlled by the drug gangs are now seeing new restaurants open, and there's little to no violent crime. But critics say the problems haven't been solved. The criminals have only been dispersed to areas where there are fewer resources and less visibility, places like Magé. Another older man describes the gunfire he also heard the other night. He lives on what was a pretty quiet neighborhood in Magé. Small, well-tended houses, a few with plants and flowers, others painted varying shades of pastels. The green hills of this mostly agricultural area frame the district. It's mid-afternoon and it feels safe and intimate. Kids are playing. People here tell me until recently this was the kind of place where you'd drop into someone's house and grab a beer from their fridge, even if they weren't home. But just up the road, there is now a place they've dubbed the Gaza Strip because of all the violence there recently. He says, with violence getting closer, of course I'm worried. The new dealers here are 13, 14, 15 years old, and they are bringing with them new habits, he says. Another middle-aged man here concurs. He's the father of a teenager. They've had a baile funky dance a few times here now across the railroad. We've never had that before, he says. It's stuff from the favelas in Rio. The new people want to influence the local people, he tells me. The funk dance parties have actually been outlawed in many pacified favelas in Rio, as they were presided over by the drug gangs, and the music glorifies the gang lifestyle. It's a worrying sign to people in the community that they are now having them here. He says he's afraid to let his son wander out late these days.
Here you used to see petty criminals armed with at most a pistol. Now these new people are carrying heavy weapons. I have a friend who's a truck driver here who saw a guy walking through the streets carrying big guns.
Magé, he explains, has always dealt with violence. It has a high homicide rate, but it's mostly due to an ingrained gun culture that sees people take the law into their own hands when there's a personal dispute. This is different, he says. He says the criminality here is still manageable, but he worries.
In 5-10 years, this will be like Rio is now.
And he says the authorities aren't doing anything to stop it.
O comandante do batalhão, na verdade, que...
The commander of the battalion here isn't taking it seriously. It's because it isn't affecting his kids. They're taking no measures. They don't really care.
A military police officer who is from Magé but works now in Rio's favelas agreed to talk to us on the condition we did not record his voice or use his name. He says the problem for law enforcement here isn't that they don't care. It's that all the resources are being put into Rio ahead of the games. He says, quote, Rio is the focus. Everything goes there. And then if anything is left over, we get it here. The priority is the mega events. For example, he says, all the new recruits now have to do a mandatory 2-year stint in the police pacification units before being able to work elsewhere. New cars, new equipment, new personnel all go to Rio first. He says, quote, the criminality hasn't ended. What happens is that they announce in advance when a favela is going to be pacified, and many of the gang members flee. All the interior of the state has gotten worse. The criminals migrated here. And he says there isn't much interest in doing anything about it because places like Magé are far from the spotlight of the upcoming games. This despite the fact that there's been a population boom here. A new Petrobras office, Brazil's state oil company, in the area is drawing new residents. But he says the government doesn't care about the interior. He says glumly he doesn't believe pacification will work in the end. Quote, it's not sustainable. It's impossible to pacify all the favelas. In fact, in Rio, activists maintain that the government isn't really trying to make life less dangerous for the poor who live in the shanty towns. They point to the fact that all the pacified areas are around the tourist districts, key infrastructure, or vital roads. There are 1,000 favelas in Rio, and only a few dozen have been pacified. The police officer agrees. Quote, pacification is for the foreigners, for our foreign image. It's dusk and the streets are slowly emptying, except for a lone teenager strumming the Brazilian version of a ukulele as he walks home. Magé becomes quiet as everyone shuts their doors for the night. Lourdes Garcia Navarro, NPR News.
And for the next week, NPR will be looking at crime and violence in South and Central America. Latin American cities are at the top of the most violent places in the world.
The region is bloodied by record-high homicide rates, drug trafficking, gang violence, police corruption, and lack of state control. The violence breeds fear and a sense of insecurity, undermining faith in state institutions and leaders and development.
In many places, criminal groups force businesses, big and small, to pay what is sometimes called a security tax. Many don't even bother to report the crime.
Tomorrow on Weekend Edition, NPR's Mexico correspondent Gary Kahn will look at the price of extortion.